Welcome to The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, Managing Editor of News at WCAI. This is our weekly news roundup when we give you the opportunity to catch up on all the news of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. And joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Hello, George.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. Thanks for being here. Joining us a little later, Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Jim DeRoot is calling in from the New Bedford Standard Times. Sally Rose, we'll hear from her from the Provincetown Banner. Joshua Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and we expect to hear from Nelson Siegelman as well. And, of course, he's the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. He always brings such levity to the show, George.
Absolutely.
Let's take a look at some of the news headlines here. Let's start with a real talker of a story, maybe not the newsiest story of the week, but something that's really caused a lot of discussion, the gravesite mementos at a cemetery in West Yarmouth.
That's right. People showed up Mother's Day weekend at one of the cemeteries in Yarmouth to find their family's mementos packed up into garbage bags and in front of the graves. And this is really disturbing to some people. Apparently, these regulations, there are regulations at the cemetery on what you can and can't have at a gravesite. But the regulations haven't been enforced up until now. The current recreation director in town who oversees the town cemeteries says, you know, she's enforcing these guidelines that have been in place for many, many years. They just haven't been enforced previously. And that's what's causing the uproar is people are saying, you know, we didn't actually know that some of these things were prohibited because, you know, everybody was doing it.
Of course. And to do it all of a sudden, and of course, Mother's Day weekend, you're talking about grieving people and go to their loved ones to, you know, give their respects. I think it came as a real surprise. That's what the selectmen seem to be saying, too.
That's right. And, you know, you could imagine probably the only worst day would be Memorial Day weekend,
oh,
you know, which is coming right up. But these types of things are in place, you know, these types of restrictions are in place at public cemeteries all over the place, and probably no more restrictive than the national cemetery we have here in Bourne, where, you know, it's very tightly monitored exactly what you can and cannot do at those grave sites. And, you know, in that case, it keeps it keeps everything uniform and looking great. And I think that's part of the issue here is, you know, Patricia Armstrong, who is the recreation director there, some of it was getting a little out of hand, what people were placing at the gravestones.
There was another front page story this week about a treasure hunter, a local gentleman folks know because of his previous archaeological work, and he now believes, or he now says, that he has found Christopher Columbus's famed Santa Maria, not off Cape Cod,
but this is a huge find if it's true. And there are some experts who are saying that there's very compelling evidence that Barry Clifford, who has found other shipwrecks, has found the Santa Maria off Haiti, 4 miles off Haiti. And the interesting thing about this is, I guess it's only in about 20 feet of water. And the water is pretty clear, but this is in a place where apparently there have been many shipwrecks in the past. It's on a reef. You know, there's an interesting tale about you know, Christopher Columbus on Christmas Eve, as the rest of his crew retired for the evening, left the helm of the ship anchored just off Haiti. And around midnight, the ship mysteriously went aground on a reef in the shallow water. Talks about it being happening very quietly. You know, Columbus actually created a settlement there in a fort called La Navidad. Now, I guess why people have never been able to find this is they were looking in the wrong spot.
Right.
They were looking east when they should have been looking west, apparently.
Well, he actually says he first saw it, came across this wreck in, I think it was 2003, didn't quite understand what they were looking at. I guess there was some sort of weapon or cannon there that they didn't quite understand how old it might be and what it actually did, so they moved on.
That's right. And he talks about he was with a television crew, apparently. And Clifford talks about being under this tremendous pressure to find something. And so they, you know, he didn't know what he was looking at here, so quickly bypassed this one and moved on to other finds, so to speak, in that area. And, you know, since that time, I guess this cannon is now gone missing because, as often happens with sites like this, when they're identified, apparently, you know, amateur divers go in and loot the sites. So Clifford is actually asking the Haiti government to step in here and protect the site, and, you know, so that historic artifacts can be preserved if it is indeed the Santa Maria.
Speaking of underwater exploration, let's talk about HUI, which does a lot of that work. They lost a submersible, I think, was it just this last week, I think, $8 million submersible. That's the cost to build it. I understand that replacing it will cost less than that. But that was an interesting story. Where were they working? Out in off New Zealand, I think.
Right, in the deepest part of the ocean. I was going to start this off, Sean, by saying I'm glad to be in a profession where the only correction that I have to do is maybe call an editor and say, you know, I got the date of an event wrong, and we have to correct that in tomorrow's paper and fix it on the online edition. Can you imagine having to call your boss and say, I just lost the $8 million submersible,
and
you know, in the deep trench of the ocean. This is really, you know, an amazing tale. They were looking, obviously, it shows just what the high risk is in the ocean, just how powerful the ocean is. They were 6.2 miles below the surface of the ocean, as you said, off New Zealand in the Kermadec Trench. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And, you know, they've already gotten some really good information from this about species they had no idea previously existed. And so, you know, part of their work had already been done. There were 30 days into a 40-day mission, you know, and you know, exploration will continue. But interesting, help me out with the name of the famous director who's worked with HUI. Is it Cameron?
Yeah, James Cameron.
James Cameron. You know, we didn't have it in our story, but there were stories out there where he's talking about how, you know, almost as if like HUI had lost a child here.
You read the end of this story, and I don't think it was Cameron, but there was someone else talking about almost the human-like nature of this particular machine.
Right.
Really interesting stuff about how persnickety it could kind of be. Yeah.
Right. You know, it's a robot, but, you know, and it's remote controlled, but they do become attached to this. And it's probably because they spent so much time at sea, and it's provided them with this information that scientists have such a thirst for in their research. And so it is a loss for them. And, you know, but there is another submersible that's already apparently in line to take over. And so, you know, obviously the work goes on. But we've learned a lot about just how volatile the ocean is, and the pressure in that deep trench that they were trying to explore.
They'd lost one before, is that correct? I think I saw that in the story.
Yes, they have.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on and talk about some legislation that has been filed, and it deals with an issue we've talked a lot about here in terms of spent fuel storage and nuclear power.
Yeah, this is one of the major concerns of people with Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant in Plymouth. Not just that the plant itself, but it's those spent fuel rods that are going to be around for a long time after that plant stops operating. And this legislation has a lot to do with how those spent rods will be worked with in the future. Right now, when they come out of the reactor, they go into a pool and to cool, and that's where many of them remain. because there is no place to ship them off to. Yucca Mountain, which was going to be a repository for these, is off the table. And so now they have to find another way to handle them.
Hey, everyone for years thought that we would find a place to put this spent fuel. That's why they allowed them to be these spent rods to be stored above the reactors or near the reactors. Which above it is what happens in Plymouth. It's like in a pool, as you say, and they were only built for so many of these rods, and they far exceeded that amount. But then they realized, well, what state wants to take all of the country's nuclear waste and stick it in a hole somewhere? And they couldn't find a state, not even Nevada, was willing to do that. But they have lots and lots of money set aside to deal with this issue. And I think they're looking to use some of that money now to compel energy companies, nuclear power companies, to put this stuff in what are called these dry casks.
That's right. This legislation is called the Dry Cask Storage Act of 2014. We should say that U.S. Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts is one of the sponsors of this bill, and it would set up strict regulations for the utilities on exactly what they have to do, and operators would have 7 years from the date they submit their plans on how they intend to deal with these spent fuel rods and put them into dry casks to report to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So,
and those dry casks did really well over at Fukushima, where they did have some spent fuel rods in a pool because they have to cool there for a significant amount of time. But they had in the dry casks, and they did very well. And it's interesting that, as you say, this legislation has some sort of penalty if they can't actually get this work done.
That's right.
And I believe some preliminary work already has been done at Pilgrim to try to move, to at least begin that process, but they say it can be a pretty dangerous process. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Tim Wood is going to join us. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll find out what happened at Chatham Town meeting and get an update on the election. I believe the election in the town election in Chatham. So we'll be back. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. And every week, Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, joins us. Hello, Tim.
Morning, Sean.
Good morning, Tim. So Chatham had its town meeting. How did it go? What were the big items?
Chatham wrapped up its town meeting in one night on Monday, which was great. The highlights of the meeting, voters said a definitive no to the Monomoy National Refuge Comprehensive Plan, specifically sections that incorporate part of the town-owned South Beach into the refuge and also an expansion of refuge management onto subtitle areas west of Monomoy. People fear that this could lead to more restrictions on both fin and shell fishing. Voters approved a non-binding resolution by 401-16 opposing those management proposals. The proposals like these have hurt the credibility of the agency, said Selectman Sean Summers, and as does their failure to negotiate about these things with the town. Now, Libby Herlin, who's the project manager for Fish and Wildlife, showed up at town meeting. She defended the plan and noted that this is a draft report and subject to revision, and that she encouraged residents to submit written comments by the July 9th deadline. So that was a major issue at town meeting. Other specifics that...
Well, Tim, let me ask, what weight does that vote carry?
It's non-binding. It's more of a sense of the town. Selectmen had decided to go this route to try to get some weight behind what they're planning to do to oppose this in the sense of going to federal legislators, trying to get Fish and Wildlife to listen closely to the town and their objection. They figured that this was would be an overwhelming sense of the town that, listen to us. We don't like this. Don't just sort of gloss over it.
Okay.
So it wasn't binding, but it's more of a real sort of getting some weight behind the selectman's position.
I see.
So other issues, a main point of discussion was the new FEMA floodplain maps. A town voted to adopt the new maps. but decided to leave the Conservancy District, which is a 50-foot zoning buffer zone from the flood zone, at its current levels rather than expand it to conform to the new maps, which increase the coverage of would have increased the coverage of the buffer zone. The Planning Board asked for more time to study the impact of that expansion. However, voters decided that the 100-foot buffer around the flood zone that's controlled by the Conservation Commission was unnecessary and voted to rescind it, even though that's been in place for a dozen years or more. Voters also rejected placing conservation restrictions on two town properties, the Grange property on Depot Road and the Riders Cove property. That's part of the Marconi complex. In both cases, voters said they did not want to preclude future uses of either of those properties by restricting them to conservation and open space only. Voters also approved the purchase of a small parcel of waterfront property on Bridge Street to guarantee public access to the water in that area. And they also endorsed a use easement on land at the Fish Pier, which is owned by Chatham Bars Inn, in order to secure the municipal use of that small chunk of land into the future. A couple other small things are, depending upon your point of view, I guess. Voters turned down a resolution calling for the town to withdraw from the Cape Cod Commission. Mm-hmm. They approved $17.5 million for the next phase of the town's sewer expansion project, and they also embraced a $6.5 million article to build an iron and manganese water treatment facility. And then the town's $27 million operating budget passed with no discussion at all.
Tim or George, I know that a lot of the communities on the Cape were voting on the Cape Cod Commission whether to withdraw from the commission. I don't think any of those were successful.
I don't know of any yet.
I don't either. Tim, you don't know of any either?
No, I haven't heard of any yet either. I think Harwich turned theirs down as well.
Okay. What about the Chatham Town election? That's this week as well.
Actually, the election was yesterday. We have a new selectman, Seth Taylor, won in a three-man race. It was his second time running for selectman, and this time last year he was unsuccessful. This time he was able to top the other two candidates, and he is actually being sworn in this morning.
Okay. And the Mitchell River Bridge construction is causing some cancellations in town?
Indeed, the first major one that we know of at this point came to light this week. The Chatham Harbor Run, which is for 35 years has passed over that bridge as part of its route around town. It's a 10K race that happens at the end of June every year. The organizers tried to work on redoing the route to avoid the bridge, but in the end they said that they'd rather cancel the race because part of the whole ambiance and charm of that race is that it goes through the town's harbors and by the lighthouse, and they didn't want to compromise that. So they canceled the race. There's still a slim possibility that they may try to work out a new route with the police department, but there isn't really much time left to do that. They'd have to work out a new route, get it certified, and put the publicity out. So it looks like that race won't happen this year and probably next year since the bridge construction is slated to happen over two summers.
I feel like we've been talking about the Mitchell River Bridge since 2005. Does that sound accurate?
Yeah, it's been about 4 years since, probably not 2005, but
okay.
It's been 4 or 5 years since the state first suggested that they were going to replace that bridge. And lots of negotiations resulted in some changes to the design, and mm-hmm. the contract for the construction was approved just a few weeks ago, and construction is supposed to begin around June 1st, and that will close off Bridge Street to through traffic for, like I said, about two summers, which is, you know, going to be an inconvenience to a lot of people, but, you know, people tend to adapt around here when something like that happens.
There you go. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. You can follow the Cape Cod Chronicle Newsroom on Twitter, at CCC Newsroom. You also can get regular updates on the Cape Cod Chronicle Facebook page or at its website, capecodchronicle.com. Thank you very much, Tim. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean.
And on the phone is Joshua Balling. He's the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the paper. Hello, Joshua.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. New Stop and Shop approved on island.
It was. Stop and Shop supermarket chain cleared a major hurdle out here on Nantucket this week in its bid to build a new supermarket on its current property between Sparks Avenue and Pleasant Street. The planning board voted 4-1 after several months of meetings and public hearings to approve the store, which is about 20% larger than the existing store. It will be flipped on the site from the current spot in the parking lot to the other side nearest the Nantucket Fire Department. Stop and Shop officials say that that will allow them to provide some more parking. Traffic congestion and parking has been an issue at the Mid-Island Stop and Shop for quite some time. The store was built in the early 60s and hasn't expanded all that much. There have been some renovations there, but Stop and Shop officials, town officials, and customers in particular say the store is undersized, doesn't have the variety they would like, particularly in the summer when Nantucket's population obviously blooms quite larger than it is in the wintertime. And even in the winter, there are times when you can go to the Stop and Shop and the parking lot is full and not as many items as you might like for a supermarket out on an island in the middle of the Atlantic.
This is going to be the News Roundup supermarket special. We're going, in a few minutes, we're going to talk about Whole Foods and Hyannis, and we're also going to hear about a Stop and Shop proposal on Martha's Vineyard. Let's move on to the Fast Ferry, another Fast Ferry approved for Nantucket, correct?
It was. Highline Cruises got Steamship Authority approval to build a very large passenger high-speed ferry, a 493-passenger, three-deck high-speed catamaran that they will use in conjunction with their current fast ferry, the Gray Lady, to provide service between Nantucket and Hyannis. The new boat will be about 150 feet in length, 12 feet longer than the current boat, with seating for about 365 indoors, 128-130 outside. And Highline says that they need to replace the current Great Point conventional ferry. They need a second fast boat. It doesn't make any sense to build another conventional ferry when the evolution of water transportation in particular is moving toward high speed. The Steamship Authority gets to vote on this because the enabling legislation that created it back in the early 1960s, in exchange for the Steamship Authority providing a reliable year-round and relatively affordable service between the mainland and the islands, they get to license their competition. And the High Line got the approval on Tuesday in New Bedford, and they hope to have the boat built in time to start running about the start of the summer of 2016.
I know there were some concerns voiced by the airport in Hyannis. Was that discussed at all?
That was not discussed at this particular meeting in New Bedford on Tuesday. Very little discussion at all, actually passed quite quickly. But that was discussed on Nantucket and in Hyannis as well. The airport commissions in both towns expressing some concern that another fast boat would eat into the air taxi service that goes back and forth between Nantucket and Hyannis. Airport officials out here last week had said that air taxi transportation and passenger numbers were down significantly since the high-speed boat started. The Nantucket Board of Selectmen weighed in last Wednesday night and essentially said that competition is good and maybe the airports and the airlines need to do something to improve the competition rather than attempt to stop another fast boat, which is the way that many islanders and many visitors seem to prefer to travel these days. It is slightly more affordable than the airlines, a little slower, an hour instead of 15 or 20 minutes, but certainly faster than the 2-hour and 15-minute slow boat ride that most of us have taken most of our lives before the High Line and the steamship started providing fast ferry service a few years ago.
And the wine festival kicks off. Is it this weekend?
The Nantucket Wine Festival is well underway. The first full day of events was yesterday. It began Wednesday night and goes right through Sunday. If you're a wine lover or even a wine spectator, I guess, Nantucket is the place to be. There's also a lot of food-related events, a lot more food has been added to the wine festival over the last couple of years. Last night was the annual Harbor Gala, which paired mostly Nantucket restaurants, but restaurants from Boston, New York, and around the region with some of the best and most famous winemakers from around the country and the world. Very well attended. There's two grand tastings, one tomorrow and one on Sunday. Lots of events, different talks, seminars, and lots of wine tasting on Nantucket this weekend.
Do you get to cover that yourself, Josh?
Not as much as I would like. I wish I could immerse myself, so to speak, but we do have some other things I have to do. And while we're on the job, there's no sampling anyway, so it's sort of not as much fun as it might be otherwise.
Well, that's a good policy. Joshua Balling is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. He's also director of digital content at the paper. You can follow Josh on Twitter at jballingim. Thank you very much, Josh.
Thank you.
And Jim Deruda is joining us. He's the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. Tell us about Taunton State Hospital. We've been following the story for quite some time since Governor Deval Patrick decided, you know what, we can close some beds there. But the legislature's kind of been holding on and saying maybe that's not the best idea. What's up now?
Well, it's for 3 years the governor has not funded beds at Taunton State, hoping to move all the beds into Worcester or Tewksbury in a brand new facility in Worcester. But a Senate committee just passed funding for 45 beds, which is what the legislature has been able to maintain since the governor's attempt to eliminate them. And that will move on to the Senate. The House has already passed the funding. And it looks like the legislature has waited out Governor Patrick's term, his second term.
Do you think the governor has given up on this at this point? Is that the impression you get?
Well, I don't think he could successfully veto it. Mm. And I think he's probably just working on principle for it.
Right. And those beds, of course, are key because where they're located. It would be a real burden to travel to someplace like Worcester.
Well, it's rough for anybody in southeastern Mass, and it's even rougher for folks on the Cape. Those are the closest beds outside of hospital emergency rooms for people needing mental health services, inpatient services.
Let's talk about the town of Westport. Interesting story here. They're suing a company. Well, you tell us. Why are they suing a company?
Monsanto, which now is mostly just a big agriculture company, of course, used to be involved in lots of chemicals. And one of the chemicals that they manufactured 50 years ago or so was PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, which are now believed to be carcinogenic. Used to be, before the 1980s when they figured that out, building codes required PCBs because it worked as fire retardant and it was safer, they thought, than...
The alternative, yeah.
Yeah, right. Horrible alternative. I can think of mesothelioma, but I can't think of the name of this stuff.
Asbestos?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
That just comes with age, you know.
yeah.
So the building codes required the PCBs in it. 3 years ago, Westport tried to replace some windows to get a little more efficiency in their buildings. They discovered the PCBs, and that came up to about a $3 million bill. In town meeting, they resisted debt exclusions and Prop 2.5 overrides, but finally realized that shuffling kids around to other schools, sequestering them in this half of the building while they tried to do something in that half of the building, they finally agreed to a loan, and it's going to cost them about $1 million in interest and $3 million in repairs, and it costs them $50,000 a year to test quarterly to make sure that the levels are safe. And they want to be reimbursed by Monsanto. Monsanto, for their part, says, look, every time we've been found to be responsible, we've taken care of our responsibility. And, you know, when this building was built, it was just part of the process.
So it's heading to the courts?
Heading to the courts.
Okay. Jim Deruda, he is the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times. You can follow the editorial page on Twitter at OpinionSCT. Of course, that SCT is for SouthCoastToday.com. That's the website. Jim, thank you very much.
And thank you, Sean.
Sally Rose is on the phone. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Sally.
Good morning, Sean. How are you?
Good morning. I understand you're joining us from Vermont, which is very nice of you. We appreciate it. Let's talk about the Massachusetts Office of Public Collaboration.
Right. Well, now they were doing a workplace study on the police department and on the just on the workplace climate, and that was after, if you recall, the chief. Former Chief Jeff Geron, he has left the department thus far, and there were some incidents involving him, one at a local bar that bothered a lot of citizens, and he was also involved in distributing selectmen's candidates' campaign signs from the police station. So the selectmen asked the Mass Office of Public Collaboration to do this workplace analysis, and so they made a presentation on Monday and on the report, and they basically said that given the turmoil of the recent past, the overall workplace climate in the department now is better than expected. So there's been significant improvement since Chief Geron left. The main problems, they said, were lack of communications concerning day-to-day information and the use of inappropriate and unprofessional language and behaviors. In some cases, it said, there's a persistent culture of fear preventing some staff members from speaking out about important matters. The report was based on a compilation of interviews that with department personnel, and that happened back in January. It also offered recommendations for improving the climate, including improving mentorship programs, communicating about and enforcing workplace policies, establishing a conflict resolution process, and they're also working to put together a civic engagement committee to create a plan for improving interactions between the department and the community.
And the selectmen were pleased by this?
Yes, they were. They're trying to encourage people to join the civic engagement committee. Interestingly, they've had a little trouble getting people to sign up for it.
They got plenty of people out at those meetings when people were upset with what was happening with the department. But
that is so true. Yes.
Okay. And of course, the anniversary of same-sex marriage is tomorrow in Massachusetts, and you have some coverage of that anniversary in the paper.
Yes, this week we have a really nice five-story collection that celebrates that 10-year anniversary. It includes a story that recalls those early days after the state Supreme Judicial Court made its groundbreaking decision, and the town began preparing for what was expecting a flood of couples wanting to get married. And Provincetown's town clerk, Doug Johnstone, remembers the emotions that filled that time, in addition to the worries that he could be punished because he and the selectmen decided to allow out-of-state couples to get licenses and marry in Provincetown in addition to Massachusetts residents. If you remember, Governor Romney threatened to enforce a 1913 law that people could not be married in Massachusetts if the marriage would not be recognized in their own state, unless, of course, it was the couple's intention to move here. And Johnstone, the town clerk, he was credited by the selectmen, including by State Rep Sarah Peek, who was a selectman in Provincetown at that time, with being basically the visionary and the one who was going out on a limb for this decision. Because Romney was threatening to punish anyone who didn't follow the rule. There's also a story on a boost to local business from this wedding tourism. The year before Massachusetts began recognizing same-sex marriages, Provincetown issued a total of 20 marriage licenses. On May 17, 2004, with the help of 75 volunteers, there were 154 marriage licenses on that day issued, and 29% of them went to out-of-state couples. So a total that year, 873 licenses were issued, and most of those, 848, went to same-sex couples.
Okay.
And it hasn't dropped below 400 since.
Real boost to the economy. Sally Rose is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Thank you very much, Sally.
Thanks, Sean.
We're going to take just a quick break here. When we come back, George Brennan is here from the Cape Cod Times. We'll also hear from Nelson Siegelman. He's the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone, Nelson Siegelman, the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Hello.
A little bit earlier, we were talking to Joshua Balling on Nantucket about a Stop and Shop approval there by town meeting. Stop and Shop being discussed on Martha's Vineyard as well, but it's the other side of the coin there.
Yes, we've been discussing it for about 10 months, and I suppose we'll go on discussing it. Stop and Shop had proposed to construct a new two-story, 30,000-square-foot market with parking on the lower level. If currently they're in really it's just a sort of cinder block of a building. It's been there for about 40 years. It used to be called the A&P. It's pretty nondescript, and what they're talking about doing is building a new market, and they would have used the entire area that they have now. They recently purchased two buildings that are adjacent to their current market, so they're going to use all that space. And after 10 months in front of the Martha's Vineyard Commission, our regional permitting body, Stop and Shop decided to withdraw its application really on the eve of a decision. A vote was expected next month, and my guess is that they just decided it might not go their way. You had two of the three Tisbury selectmen opposed, the Tisbury Planning Board opposed, and pretty much it came down to size. A lot of the opposition was based on just the size of the building. So it's hard to say what's going to happen next, but...
Well, reading the story in the Martha's Vineyard Times, I think you might have written it, it seemed like the comments coming out of Stop and Shop were pretty positive. They actually complimented the Martha's Vineyard Commission for the work that it does. And so, I mean, they're keeping relations really, really good in the
Well,
in the
yes. I mean, one would expect that from a big corporation. They're going to be diplomatic. I mean, it's... I wouldn't have expected after, you know, knowing that they're going to come back, that they'd say, okay, we're done with you. But so I don't read a lot into that. They said all the right things, and hopefully they'll be able to sit down with town leaders and come up with a plan that works for everybody, because there's no question that that building is really in sorry shape and something needs to be done. It's just everybody needs to get on the same page. It's just unfortunate that after 10 months they weren't able to do that.
Very interesting story in the paper this week about the beaches and water quality. This is actually a story that will affect many communities in Massachusetts.
Yes, this happened, this isn't just Martha's Vineyard. I know Nantucket, Cape beaches, and beaches along the Massachusetts coast. Under the old rules, if you took a water sample test and it showed indication of Enterococci bacteria above a certain level, the managers were required to close that beach. And that could be really problematic because there's a lag time. You take the test, you get the test results. Now it shows it's high, you have to close it. You're taking another test, you're waiting for the results. And, of course, this is all happening in July and August when people come to the Cape and the islands to go to the beach. Now... you'd have to have a failed test on two consecutive days, not just one day. So it gives it a little bit more latitude. There are some exceptions for beaches that have been consistently problematic, but this will help with some of these open ocean beaches. And, you know, it was just a real mystery why a beach on the open Atlantic Ocean would suddenly show a poor test. So that hasn't been solved, but at least this way, if it's just a passing phenomenon, it won't shut down a beach for 3 or 4 days.
It was really interesting. One of the public health officials quoted in the story was saying, look, it could have been a heavy rainfall that affected the test, but she made the point that only 0.02% of all the beaches tested ever failed 2 days in a row. To the point
right.
that you were making.
So it's really, I mean, you look at on our south shore here, Long Point Beach, that's open ocean. I mean, what? there's nothing around there. So it had to be something more at work than a source of pollution, maybe from one of the larger cities. I don't know, maybe New York is testing us. Who knows? But this will help on those warm summer days when you want to go to the beach and you can now get there.
Okay. Nelson Siegelman is the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you very much, Nelson. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay. And George Brennan is here from the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. George, let's talk about parking in Hyannis, the Ocean Street lot. A little earlier, we were talking about people who take the ferry over to Nantucket, and apparently some folks use this parking lot.
That's right. Of course, there are paid lots closer to the ferries, but a lot of contractors use this particular lot on Ocean Street because, It's expensive for them to get back and forth to the island already, and to add money to park is somewhat of a hardship for them. And so they park in this lot, walk down to the ferry. It's not that far. It's actually right across the street from the Cape Cod Times offices. And so, it's a quick little walk down there with their lunch container and their other equipment and. They hop on the ferry and go over to the island for the day. The city of Barnstable is saying, "Look, we can't have this because in the summertime there's limited parking, and they want to start charging for this parking to, both deter someone from parking there all day who's going over to the island all day,
right?
And
they want to promote also, turnover for the for the businesses.
Turnover for the businesses, exactly. And so one of the interesting things I thought about this story, and I kind of like this, is that there would be an app on a smartphone app that you could add time.
Oh.
If your time's about to run out and you know it's about to run out, you just pull out your iPhone.
Isn't that feeding the meter? Haven't we been taught we're not supposed to do that?
Well, I guess so. But you know, if you're a city or town looking for revenue,
yes, it makes sense. Now that lot's kind of tucked away. If you don't know it's there, I think it's hard to kind of.
Yeah, it's one of those. It's just off of Main Street. It's between Ocean Street goes between the Cape Cod Times and this lot. And yeah, you're right. It's kind of tucked behind there. It's right adjacent to the Village Green.
Oh,
there.
Right.
And so. Yeah, you would have to know that that lot is there in order to find it. But we talked to a contractor for this story, and obviously he finds it every morning, and it's his way to save a little money in making that jaunt every day over to the islands to do his work.
There was a meeting this week about some renewable energy groups here and some discussions in front of the Department of Public Utilities. Briefly, tell us what this was about.
Well, this is the Cape Light Compact. They've been in existence now for 17 years, and there's both proponents and opponents of Cape Light Compact. Many people say that they've saved ratepayers money by instituting some cost-saving measures. They go out, they're the organization that will come out and they'll do an audit, an energy audit, and many of their customers believe that they've saved hundreds and hundreds of dollars. There are others who say that this organization just isn't forthright enough, that there's not enough transparency in what they do. And so there was a lot of that discussion before DPU officials here on Cape Cod.
Yeah, didn't see a lot new in that particular discussion. Interesting story out of Mashpee. I've done a lot of coverage of ticks and Lyme disease, and I'm interested in this tick disease center, which has opened in Mashpee.
You know, Mashpee is that community where Lyme disease seems to really have a focus.
I mean, the town is covered in green ribbons right now.
Absolutely.
For Lyme disease awareness.
The point I was going to make is you can't drive through there. You see them and you wonder, what's that? And then you think, oh, yeah, Lyme disease. But this particular, it's called the Entire Health and Wellness Center. It's at Trinity Place on Route 28. And they're going to take a holistic approach to Lyme disease and helping folks with this really debilitating illness.
Yeah, a lot of information will be available there, and I know the people with Lyme disease, particularly Lyme disease, they've had for a long time, and that's a controversial thing. They have lists of doctors that they know can really Lyme. What do they call them? Lyme literate doctors. Mm-hmm. And so there's a whole network among folks who have suffered with this. Dan Tridle wants me apparently to mention that we had a tick in our control room this week in the wastebasket. I'm sure that sent shivers up Dan Tridle's spine. It was a dog tick, Dan. You don't have to worry so much, but they do carry diseases as well. New Whole Foods market in Hyannis.
We talked about this before we went on air, and there's a lot of excitement on Cape Cod.
Yeah.
We're not among them,
no,
Sean
no.
And I just Whole Foods, I guess it's a great market. People like it for the fact that a lot of the products are organic. This particular Whole Foods, and I'm sure it's true of others, they're using a lot of Cape Cod products.
Yes.
And that was a big emphasis of the story. Mm-hmm. Everything from bread to ice cream to fish.
I also heard from one of the folks who runs a food pantry on Cape Cod that they're donating on a very regular basis, I think a daily basis, a significant amount of food for the pantries as well.
That's right. And, interesting aspect of this story. We did a little price comparison. We sent someone in to look at prices on various things. I'm thinking the only thing that I could really afford from Whole Foods is the pasta.
Okay. Afford monetarily, you mean?
That's correct.
I see. Great story. Interesting story today about a Kentucky Derby participant, a horse that is owned, or at least partially owned, locally, that did pretty well in the Derby when it wasn't even expected to be there.
Let's see, win, place, and show. So it placed this particular horse. Mike and Eileen Tivnan are part owners of this horse. The horse's name is Commanding Curve, and it's one of those horses that will give you heart palpitations if you're the owner, because apparently it starts out at the back of the pack, as it did at the Kentucky Derby, and then it makes this run at the end. And had the track been a little bit longer, it might have overtaken and won the Kentucky Derby. We'll next get to see this horse coming up, not this weekend, because it's not going to run the second race of the Triple Crown, but it is going to run in the Belmont Stakes, which is a little bit of a longer race. So we may have a local connection to a winner of one of the three in the Triple Crown. So
the price of the horse was interesting, too. These types of horses with the lineage that they have can go for $500,000 or more. This one.
That's right. This one only went for $75,000, where... You know, as you said, they can command much higher prices. And it does come from a line of Triple Crown winners, Secretariat and Seattle Slough. I remember watching them as a kid on ABC's Wild World of Sports. My mother going crazy, even though she didn't have any money on it. She was a big horse racing fan.
Earlier this week here on WCAI and On the Point, we discussed the Hawthorne Barn, which is... experiencing a 21st century revival. A group called 20summers.org is behind opening the barn back up to art and performance. Tell us about this.
That's right. They're going to have concerts, readings, and plays and art classes there over the summer. This is 100 years of history, and when you read the names, Jackson Pollock, Tennessee Williams, Norman Rockwell, Norman Mailer, I mean, it's just incredible, the amount of history. As Eric Williams writes, you can almost see the ghosts of the artists working in the Hawthorne Barn. And I thought an interesting note of this is the parents of Robert De Niro apparently met as art students in this building. So that particular building may be responsible for De Niro.
Well, Charles Webster Hawthorne showed up in Provincetown in the late 1800s and the 1890s, and really his arrival and the opening of his school, the Cape Cod School of Art, in this barn kind of marks the beginning of Provincetown as an art colony. So I'd done a story for NPR back in 2007 about this barn when it looked like this thing was going to become condos. And so it's really good to see that someone stepped up, was able to kind of save the barn. It's been a whole group effort, and now they're opening up to, I think it's 30 days of different performances. And actually on WCAI, we're going to be broadcasting one of those performances on June 3rd from the May 31st event, so folks can tune in for that. Sandwich has a big celebration this weekend. I thought it was going to be tomorrow, but it's changed.
Right. Rain in the forecast for tomorrow. I mean, earlier in the week, they were predicting really bad rainstorm. It's still going to rain tomorrow, apparently, from the forecasts I've heard. Earlier in the week, organizers said, we don't want to jeopardize this event, and they're going to move it on all the activities until Sunday. And so this is what they're doing is they call it a bash weekend, and it's bringing alive Sandwich history. They're going to transform the center of town to 1600s. So they're going to have like a Wampanoag campsite. Miles Standish will be there at the Huxley House.
Wow.
So there's a lot of events happening there. It's most of them are free.
Oh, that sounds great. You weren't here, George. Last week we talked about the opening of the Sandwich Bubbler in downtown. I know that's a story you've been following very closely, and it is open, and so people can go by and fill up their jugs once again.
Absolutely.
I want to thank George Brennan, the reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online, for joining me in our Woods Hole studio. Thanks, George.
Thank you.
You can follow George on Twitter at GPB227. Thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim Deruta of the New Bedford Standard Times, Sally Rose from the Provincetown Banner, Joshua Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you for listening to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran.